E-29 his own. When he dropped by late in the afternoon to inspect it and found Enola Gay painted on its fuselage, he was furious. "What the hell is that doing on my plane?" one of his crewmates remembers him yelling. He found out that Tibbetts had authorized the christening and marched off to confront him. The 509th commander told him coolly, rank having its privileges, that he didn't think the junior officer would mind. Lewis minded, but he could do no more than stow away his resentment for the war stories he would tell. By dinner time on the 5th, Tibbetts narrates, all preparations were completed. The atom bomb was ready. The planes were gassed and checked. Takeoff was set for 2:45 a.m. I tried to nap, but visitors kept me up. Captain Theodore J. Dutch Van Kirk, the Enola Gay's navigator, swallowed 2 sleeping tablets, then sat up wide awake all night playing poker. The weapon waiting in the bomb bay took its toll on nerves. Final briefing was at 0:00 of August 6th, Ramsey notes, midnight. Tibbetts emphasized the power of the bomb, reminded the men to wear the polarized goggles that they had been issued, cautioned them to obey orders and follow their protocols. A weather officer predicted moderate winds with clouds over the targets clearing at dawn. Tibbetts called forward a Protestant chaplain who delivered a prayer composed for the occasion on the back of an envelope. It asked the Almighty Father to be with those who brave the heights of thy heaven and who carry the battle to our enemies. After the midnight briefing, the crews ate an early breakfast of ham and eggs and Tibbetts' favorite pineapple fritters. Trucks delivered them to their hardstands. At the Enola Gay's hardstand, writes Ramsey, amid brilliant floodlights, pictures were taken and retaken by still and motion picture photographers, as though for a Hollywood premiere. A photograph shows 10 of the 12 members of the strike plane's crew posed in flight coveralls under the forward fuselage by the nose wheel. Boyish Van Kirk in overseas cap, with his coveralls unzipped down his chest to expose a white t-shirt. Major Thomas Farabee, the bombardier, a handsome Errol Flynn copy with an Errol Flynn mustache, resting a friendly hand on Van Kirk's shoulder. Tibbetts, standing at the center of it all, easily smiling, belted and trim, his hands in his pockets. At Tibbetts' left, Robert Lewis, the only crew member wearing a weapon. Small, wiry Lieutenant Jacob Beezer, beside Lewis, awkwardly smiling. A Jewish technician from Baltimore added for the flight, responsible for electronic countermeasures to screen the Archie units from Japanese radar. In front of the officers kneel the slimmer, mostly younger enlisted men, though the entire flight crew was young, Tibbetts now all of 30 years old. Radar operator Sergeant Joseph Stiborik, tail gunner Staff Sergeant Robert Caron, Brooklyn-born, wearing a Dodgers baseball cap. Radio operator Private Richard R. Nelson, Assistant Engineer Sergeant Robert H. Schumert, Flight Engineer Staff Sergeant Wyatt Dusenbury, 32, a former Michigan tree surgeon who thought the bomb looked like a tree trunk. An 11th member of the crew, Second Lieutenant Morris Jepson, an ordnance expert, would assist Deke Parsons in arming and monitoring little boy. Parsons, the 12th man, resisted photographing, but was flying the mission as weaponeer. The 3 weather planes and the 2 Iwo Jima standby had already left. Tibbetts ordered Wyatt Dusenbury to start engines at 0227 hours. Pilot and co-pilot sat side by side just back of the point where the cylindrical fuselage began to curve inward to form the bullet-shaped nose. Farabee, the bombardier, sat a step down ahead of them, within the nose itself, an exposed position, but a good view. Almost everything inside the aircraft was painted a dull lime green. It was just another mission, Tibbetts says, if you didn't let imagination run away with your wits. As Dimples 8-2, the Enola Gay's unlikely designation that day, he reconstructs his dialogue with the Tinian control tower. I forgot the atom bomb and concentrated on the cockpit check. I called the tower. Dimples 8-2 to North Tinian Tower. Taxi out and take off instructions. Dimples 8-2 from North Tinian Tower. Take off to the east on runway A for Able. At the end of the runway, Another call to the tower and a quick response. Dimples 8-2 cleared for takeoff. Bob Lewis called off the time. 15 seconds to go. 10 seconds. 5 seconds. Get ready. At that moment, the Enola Gay weighed 65 tons. It carried 7,000 gallons of fuel and a 4-ton bomb. It was 15,000 pounds overweight. Confident the aircraft was maintained too well to falter, Tibbetts decided to use as much of the 2-mile runway as he needed to build RPMs and manifold pressure before roll-up. He eased the brakes at 0245, the 4 fuel-injected Wright Cyclone engines pounding. The B-29 has lots of torque in takeoff, he notes. It wants to swerve off the runway to the left. The average mass production pilot offsets torque by braking his right wheels. It's a rough ride. You lose 10 miles an hour, and you delay the takeoff. Nothing so crude for Tibbetts. Pilots of the 509th group were taught to cancel torque by leading in with the left engines, advancing throttles ahead of the right engines. At 80 miles an hour, you get full rudder control, advance the right-hand engines to full power, and in a moment, you're airborne. Takeoff needed longer than a moment for the Enola Gay's overloaded flight. As the runway disappeared beneath the big bomber, Lewis fought the urge to pull back the yoke. At the last possible takeoff point, he thought he did. Not he, but Tibbetts did. And abruptly, they were flying. An old dream of men, climbing above a black sea. 10 minutes later, they crossed the northern tip of Saipan on a course northwest by north at 4,700 feet. The air temperature was a balmy 72 degrees. They were flying low to burn lifting fuel, and for the comfort of the two weaponeers, Parsons and Jepson, who had to enter the unpressurized, unheated bomb bay to finish assembling the bomb. That work began at 0300. It was demanding in the cramped confines of the loaded bomb bay, but not dangerous. There was only minimal risk of explosion. The green plugs that blocked the firing signal and prevented accidental detonation were plugged into the weapon. Parsons confirmed that fact first of all. Next, he removed a rear plate, removed an armor plate beneath, exposing the cannon breech, inserted a wrench into the breech plug, and rotated the wrench about 16 times to unscrew the plug, removed it, and placed it carefully on a rubber pad. He inserted the 4 sections of cordite one at a time, red ends to breech. He replaced the breech plug and tightened it home, connected the firing line, reinstalled the 2 metal plates, and with Jepson's help, removed and secured the tools and the catwalk. Little Boy was complete, but not yet armed. The charge loading took 15 minutes. They spent another 15 minutes checking monitoring circuitry at the panel installed at the weaponeer's position in the forward section. Then, except for monitoring, their work was done until time to arm the bomb. Robert Lewis kept a journal of the flight. William L. Lawrence, the New York Times science editor attached to the Manhattan Project, had traveled out to Tinian, expecting to go along. When he learned, to his bitter disappointment, that his participation had been deleted, he asked Lewis to take notes. The co-pilot imagined himself writing a letter to his mother and father, but appears to have sensed that the world would be looking over his shoulder and styled his entries with regular Air Force bonhomie. At 45 minutes out of our base, he began, self-consciously, everyone is at work. Colonel Tibbetts has been hard at work with the usual tasks that belong to the pilot of a B-29. Captain Van Kirk, navigator, and Sergeant Stiborik, radio operator, are in continuing conversation as they are shooting bearings on the Northern Marianas and making radar wind runs. No mention of Parsons or Jepson, oddly enough, though Lewis could have seen the bomb hanging in its bay through the round port below the tunnel opening straight back from his co-pilot's seat. The automatic pilot, personified as George, was flying the plane, which Tibbetts stationed below 5,000 feet. The commander realized he was tired, Lewis records. The colonel, better known as the Old Bull, shows signs of a tough day. With all he's had to do to get this mission off, he is deserving of a few winks, so I'll have a bite to eat and look after George. Rather than sleep, Tibbetts crawled through the 30-foot tunnel to chat with the waste crew, wondering if they knew what they were carrying. "A chemist's nightmare," the tail gunner, Robert Caron, guessed. "Then, a physicist's nightmare." "Not exactly," Tibbetts hedged. Tibbetts was leaving by the time Caron put two and two together. Tibbetts stayed a little longer, and then started to crawl forward up the tunnel. I remembered something else, just as the last of the old man was disappearing. I sort of tugged at his foot, which was still showing. He came sliding back in a hurry, thinking maybe something was wrong. "What's the matter?" I looked at him and said, "Colonel, are we splitting atoms today?" This time, he gave me a really funny look and said, "That's about it." Caron's third try, which he styles a lucky guess, apparently decided Tibbetts to complete the crew's briefing. Back in his seat, he switched on the interphone, called attention, and remember saying something like, "Well, boys, here's the last piece of the puzzle." They carried an atomic bomb, he told them, the first to be dropped from an airplane. They were not physicists. They understood, at least, that the weapon was different from any other ever used in war. Lewis took control from George to weave his way through a mass of towering cumuli, clouds black in the darkness that swept aside to reveal a sky shot with stars. "At 4:30, he jotted, "we saw signs of a late moon in the east. I think everyone will feel relieved when we have left our bomb with the Japs and get halfway home. Or better still, all the way home." Farabee in the nose was quiet. Lewis suspected he was thinking of home. In the Midwest part of old USA. The bombardier was in fact from Mocksville, North Carolina, close enough to the Midwest for a native of New York. Dawn, lightning a little past 0500, cheered them. "It looks at this time," Lewis wrote, coming out of the clouds, "that we will have clear sailing for a long spell." At 0552, they approached Iwo Jima, and Tibbetts began climbing to 9,300 feet to rendezvous with the observation and photography planes. The Enola Gay circled left over Iwo, found its two escorts, and moved on, its course continuing northwest by north toward the archipelago of green islands the men called the Empire. "After leaving Iwo, we began to pick up some low stratus," Lewis resumes his narrative, "and before long, we were flying on top of an undercast. At 7:10, the undercast began to break up a little bit. Outside of a high, thin cirrus and the low stuff, it's a very beautiful day. We are now about 2 hours from bombs away." They flew into history through a middle world, suspended between sky and sea, drinking coffee and eating ham sandwiches, engines droning, the smell of hot electronics in the air. At 0730, Parsons visited the bomb bay for the last time, to arm Little Boy, exchanging its green plugs for red and activating its internal batteries. Tibbetts was about to begin the 45-minute climb to altitude. Jepson worked his console. Parsons told Tibbetts that Little Boy was final. Lewis overheard. The bomb was now independent of the plane. It was a peculiar sensation. I had a feeling the bomb had a life of its own now that had nothing to do with us. I wished it were over, and we were at this same position on the way back to Tinian. "Well, folks, it won't be long now," the co-pilot added as Tibbetts increased power to climb. The weather plane at Hiroshima reported in at 0815, 0715 Hiroshima time. It found 2/10 cloud cover lower and middle and 2/10 at 15,000 feet. The other two target weather reports followed. "Our primary is the best target," Lewis wrote enthusiastically. "So, with everything going well so far, we will make a bomb run on Hiroshima." "It's Hiroshima," Tibbetts announced to the crew. They leveled at 31,000 feet at 0840. They had pressurized the aircraft and heated it against an outside temperature of negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit. 10 minutes later, they achieved landfall over Shikoku, the smaller home island east of Hiroshima, a city which looks southeastward from the coast of Honshu into the Inland Sea. As we are approaching our target, Ferriby, Van Kirk, and Staborik are coming into their own, while the Colonel and I are standing by and giving the boys what they need. Correcting course, Lewis means, aligning the plane. He got excited then, or busy. There will be a short intermission while we bomb our target. But bombing the target was the main event. The crew pulled on heavy flak suits, cumbersome protection the pilots disdained. No Japanese fighters came up to meet them, nor were they bothered by flak. The two escort planes dropped back to give the Enola Gay room. Tibbetts reminded his men to wear their protective goggles. They carried no maps. They had studied aerial photographs and knew the target city well. It was distinctive, in any case, sited on a delta divided by the channels of 7 distributaries. 12 miles from the target, Tibbetts remembers, Ferriby called, "I see it!" He clutched in his bomb sight and took control of the plane from me for a visual run. Dutch Van Kirk kept giving me radar course corrections. He was working with the radar operator. I couldn't raise them on the interphone to tell them Ferriby had the plane. The bombardier flew the plane through his bomb sight. The knurled knobs he adjusted, instructing the automatic pilot to make minor corrections in course. They crossed the inland sea on a heading only 5 degrees south of due west. Van Kirk noticed 8 large ships south of them in Hiroshima Harbor. The Enola Gay's ground speed then was 285 knots, about 328 miles per hour. Above a fork in the Ota River in central Hiroshima, a T-shaped bridge spanned the river and connected to the island formed by the 2 distributaries. The Aoi Bridge, not a war plant surrounded by workers' houses, was Ferriby's chosen aiming point. Second Army headquarters was based nearby. Tibbetts had called the bridge the most perfect AP he'd seen in the whole damn war. Ferriby had the drift well killed, but the rate was off a little. He made 2 slight corrections. A loud blip in the radio notified the escort B-29s that the bomb would drop in 2 minutes. After that, Tom looked up from his bomb sight and nodded to me. It was going to be okay. He motioned to the radio operator to give the final warning. A continuous tone signal went out, telling the escorts, in 15 seconds, she goes. The distant weather planes also heard the radio signal. So did the spare B-29 parked on Iwo Jima. It alerted Luis Alvarez in the observation plane to prepare to film the oscilloscopes he had installed there. The radio-linked parachute gauges he had designed to measure Little Boy's explosive yield hung in the bomb bay, waiting to drop with the bomb and float down toward the city. Hiroshima unrolled east to west in the crosshairs of Thomas Ferriby's Norden bombsight. The bomb bay doors were open. Ferriby had flown 63 combat missions in Europe before returning to the United States to instruct and then to join the 509th. Before the war, he had wanted to be a baseball player and had got as far as spring tryouts with a major league team. He was 24 years old. The radio tone ended, Tibbetts says tersely. The bomb dropped. Ferriby unclutched his sight. The arming wires pulled out to start Little Boy's clocks. The first combat atomic bomb fell away from the plane, then nosed down. It was inscribed with autographs and messages, some of them obscene. "Greetings to the Emperor from the men of the Indianapolis," one challenged. 4 tons lighter, the B-29 jumped. Tibbetts dove away. I threw off the automatic pilot and hauled Enola Gay into the turn. I pulled anti-glare goggles over my eyes. I couldn't see through them. I was blind. I threw them to the floor. A bright light filled the plane. The first shock wave hit us. We were 11.5 miles slant range from the atomic explosion, but the whole airplane cracked and crinkled from the blast. I yelled flak, thinking a heavy gun battery had found us. The tail gunner had seen the first wave coming, a visible shimmer in the atmosphere, but he didn't know what it was until it hit. When the second wave came, he called out a warning. We turned back to look at Hiroshima. The city was hidden by that awful cloud, boiling up mushrooming, terrible, and incredibly tall. No one spoke for a moment. Then everyone was talking. I remember Lewis pounding my shoulder, saying, "Look at that! Look at that! Look at that!" Tom Farabee wondered about whether radioactivity would make us all sterile. Lewis said he could taste atomic fission. He said it tasted like lead. "Fellows," Tibbetts announced on the interphone, "you have just dropped the first atomic bomb in history." Van Kirk remembers the two shock waves, one direct, one reflected from the ground, vividly. "It was very much as if you've ever sat on an ash can and had somebody hit it with a baseball bat. The plane bounced. It jumped, and there was a noise like a piece of sheet metal snapping. Those of us who had flown quite a bit over Europe thought that it was anti-aircraft fire that had exploded very close to the plane." The apparent proximity of the explosion would be one of its trademarks, much as its heat had seemed intimate to Philip Morrison and his colleagues at Trinity. Turning, diving, circling back to watch, the crew of the Enola Gay missed the early fireball. When they looked again, Hiroshima smothered under a pall. Lewis, in a post-war interview: "I don't believe anyone ever expected to look at a sight quite like that. Where we had seen a clear city 2 minutes before, we could now no longer see the city. We could see smoke and fires creeping up the sides of the mountains." Van Kirk: "If you want to describe it as something you were familiar with, a pot of boiling black oil. I thought, thank God the war is over and I don't have to get shot at anymore. I can go home." It was a sentiment hundreds of thousands of American soldiers and sailors would soon express, and it was hard earned. Leaving the scene, the tail gunner, Robert Caron, had a long view. "I kept shooting pictures and trying to get the mess down over the city. All the while I was describing this on the intercom. The mushroom itself was a spectacular sight, a bubbling mass of purple-gray smoke, and you could see it had a red core in it, and everything was burning inside. As we got farther away, we could see the base of the mushroom, and below, we could see what looked like a few hundred-foot layer of debris and smoke and what have you. I was trying to describe the mushroom, this turbulent mass. I saw fires springing up in different places, like flames shooting up on a bed of coals. I was asked to count them. I said, 'Count them?' Hell, I gave up when there were about 15. They were coming too fast to count. I can still see it, that mushroom and that turbulent mass. It looked like lava or molasses covering the whole city, and it seemed to flow outward up into the foothills, where the little valleys would come into the plain, with fires starting up all over, so pretty soon it was hard to see anything because of the smoke." Jacob Besser, the electronic countermeasures officer, an engineering student at Johns Hopkins before he enlisted, found an image from the seashore for the turmoil he saw. "That city was burning for all she was worth. It looked like, well, did you ever go to the beach and stir up the sand in shallow water and see it all billow up? That's what it looked like to me." Little Boy exploded at 8:16:02 Hiroshima time, 43 seconds after it left the Enola Gay, 1,900 feet above the courtyard of Shima Hospital, 550 feet southeast of Thomas Farabee's aiming point, Aioi Bridge, with a yield equivalent to 12,500 tons of TNT. "It was all impersonal," Paul Tibbetts would come to say. It was not impersonal for Robert Lewis. "If I live 100 years, he wrote in his journal, "I'll never quite get these few minutes out of my mind." Nor would the people of Hiroshima. In my mind's eye, like a waking dream, I could still see the tongues of fire at work on the bodies of men. Masuji Ibuse, Black Rain. The settlement on the delta islands of the Ota River in southwestern Honshu was named Ashihara, Reed Field, or Gokuara, Five Villages, before the feudal lord Teramuto Mori built a fortress there between 1589 and 1591 to secure an outlet for his family holdings on the inland sea. Mori called his fortress Hiroshima-jo, Broad Island Castle, and gradually the town of merchants and artisans that grew up around it acquired its name. It was an 800-foot rectangle of massive stone walls protected within a wide rectangular moat, one corner graced by a high, white, pagoda-like tower with five progressively inset roofs. The Mori family soon lost its holdings to the stronger Fukushima family, which lost them in turn to the Asano family in 1619. The Asanos had the good sense to have allied themselves closely with the Tokugawa shogunate and ruled Hiroshima fief within that alliance for the next 2.5 centuries. Across those centuries, the town prospered. The Asanos saw to its progressive enlargement by filling in the estuarial shallows to connect its islands. Divided then into long, narrow districts by the Ota's 7 distributaries, Hiroshima assumed the form of an open, extended hand. The restoration of the Meiji Emperor in 1868 and the abolition of the feudal clan system transformed Hiroshima fief into Hiroshima Prefecture, and the town, like the country, began vigorously to modernize. A physician was appointed its first mayor in 1889, when it officially became a city. The population that celebrated the change numbered 83,387. 5 years of expensive landfill and construction culminated that year in the opening of Ujina Harbor, a reclamation project that established Hiroshima as a major commercial port. Railroads came through at the turn of the century. By then, Hiroshima and its castle had found further service as an army base, and the Imperial Army 5th Division was quartered in barracks within and around the castle grounds. The 5th Division was the first to be shipped to battle when Japan and China initiated hostilities in 1894. Ujina Harbor served as a major point of embarkation and would continue in that role for the next 50 years. The Meiji Emperor moved his headquarters to the castle in Hiroshima in September, the better to direct the war, and the Diet met in extraordinary session in a provisional Diet building there. Until the following April, when the limited mainland war ended with a Japanese victory that included the acquisition of Formosa and the southern part of Manchuria, Hiroshima was de facto the capital of Japan. Then the emperor returned to Tokyo, and the city consolidated its gains. It acquired further military and industrial investments in the first 3 decades of the 20th century, as Japan turned to increasing international adventure. But the Second World War, an American study noted in the autumn of 1945, Hiroshima was a city of considerable military importance. It contained the Second Army headquarters, which commanded the defense of all of southern Japan. The city was a communication center, a storage point, and an assembly area for troops. To quote a Japanese report, "Probably more than 1,000 times since the beginning of the war did the Hiroshima citizens see off with cries of Banzai the troops leaving from the harbor." From Hiroshima in 1945, the Japanese Army General Staff prepared to direct the defense of Kyushu against the impending American invasion. Earlier in the war, the city's population had approached 400,000, but the threat of strategic bombing, so ominously delayed, had led the authorities to order a series of evacuations. On August 6th, the resident population numbered some 280,000 to 290,000 civilians, plus about 43,000 soldiers. Given that proportion of civilian to military, more than 6 to 1, Hiroshima was not, as Truman had promised in his Potsdam Diary, a purely military target. It was not without responsibility, however, in serving the ends of the war. The hour was early, the morning still warm and beautiful, a Hiroshima physician, Michihiko Hachiya, the director of the Hiroshima Communications Hospital, begins a diary of the events little boy entrained on August 6th. Shimmering leaves, reflecting sunlight from a cloudless sky, made a pleasant contrast with shadows in my garden. The temperature at 8 o'clock was 80 degrees, the humidity 80%, the wind calm. The 7 branches of the Ota flowed past crowds of citizens walking and bicycling to work. The streetcars that clanged outside Fukuya Department Store 2 blocks north of Aioi Bridge were packed. Thousands of soldiers, bare to the waist, exercised at morning calisthenics on the east and west parade grounds that flanked Hiroshima Castle, a long block west of the T-shaped bridge. More than 8,000 schoolgirls, ordered to duty the day before, worked outdoors in the central city, helping to raise houses to clear fire breaks against the possibility of an incendiary attack. An air raid alert at 7:09, the 509th weather plane, had been called off at 7:31 when the B-29 left the area. 3 more Bisons approaching just before 8:15 sent hardly anyone to cover, though many raised their eyes to the high silver instruments to watch. "Just as I looked up at the sky," remembers a girl who was 5 years old at the time and safely at home in the suburbs, "there was a flash of white light, and the green in the plants looked in that light like the color of dry leaves." Closer was more brutal illumination. A young woman helping to clear fire breaks, a junior college student at the time, recalls, "Shortly after, the voice of our teacher saying, 'Oh, there's a bee,' made us look up at the sky. We felt a tremendous flash of lightning. In an instant, we were blinded, and everything was just a frenzy of delirium." Closer still, in the heart of the city, no one survived to report the coming of the light. The constrained witness of investigative groups must serve instead for testimony. A Yale medical school pathologist working with a joint American-Japanese study commission a few months after the war, Everell A. LeBeau, observes, "Accompanying the flash of light was an instantaneous flash of heat. Its duration was probably less than 1/10 of a second, and its intensity was sufficient to cause nearby flammable objects to burst into flame and to char poles as far as 4,000 yards away from the hypocenter, that is, the point on the ground directly below the fireball. At 600 to 700 yards, it was sufficient to chip and roughen granite. The heat also produced bubbling of tile to about 1,300 yards. It has been found by experiment that to produce this effect, a temperature of 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit acting for 4 seconds is necessary. But under these conditions, the effect is deeper, which indicates that the temperature was higher and the duration less during the Hiroshima explosion. Because the heat in the flash comes in such a short time," adds a Manhattan Project study, "there is no time for any cooling to take place, and the temperature of a person's skin can be raised 120 degrees Fahrenheit in the first millisecond at a distance of 2.3 miles. The most authoritative study of the Hiroshima bombing, begun in 1976 in consultation with 34 Japanese scientists and physicians, reviews the consequences of this infernal isolation, which, at half a mile from the hypocenter, was more than 3,000 times as energetic as the sunlight that had shimmered on Dr. Hachiya's leaves. The temperature at the site of the explosion reached 5,400 degrees Fahrenheit, and primary atomic bomb thermal injury was found in those exposed within 2 miles of the hypocenter. Primary burns are injuries of a special nature and not ordinarily experienced in everyday life." This Japanese study distinguishes 5 grades of primary thermal burns, ranging from grade 1, red burn, through grade 3, white burn, to grade 5, carbonized skin with charring. It finds that severe thermal burns of over grade 5 occurred within 0.6 to 1 mile of the hypocenter, and those of grades 1 to 4 occurred as far as 2 to 2.5 miles from the hypocenter. Extremely intense thermal energy leads not only to carbonization, but also to evaporation of the viscera. People exposed within half a mile of the little boy fireball, that is, were seared to bundles of smoking black char in a fraction of a second as their internal organs boiled away. "Doctor," a patient commented to Michihiko Hachiya a few days later, "a human being who has been roasted becomes quite small, doesn't he?" The small black bundles, now stuck to the streets and bridges and sidewalks of Hiroshima, numbered in the thousands. At the same instant, birds ignited in midair. Mosquitoes and flies, squirrels, family pets crackled and were gone. The fireball flashed an enormous photograph of the city at the instant of its immolation,
fixed on the mineral, vegetable, and animal surfaces of the city itself.
A spiral ladder left its shadow in unburned paint on the surface of a steel storage tank. Leaves shielded reverse silhouettes on charred telephone poles. The black-brushed calligraphy burned out of a rice paper name card posted on a school building door. The dark flowers burned out of a schoolgirl's light blouse. A human being left the memorial of his outline in unspalled granite on the steps of a bank. Another, pulling a handcart, protected a handcart and human-shaped surface of asphalt from boiling. Farther away, in the suburbs, the flash-induced dark, sunburn-like pigmentation sharply shadowed deep in human skin, streaking the shape of an exposed nose or ear or hand raised in gesture onto the faces and bodies of startled citizens. The mask of Hiroshima, Liebau and his colleagues came to call that pigmentation. They found it persisting unfaded 5 months after the event. The world of the dead is a different place from the world of the living, and it is hardly possible to visit there. That day in Hiroshima, the two worlds nearly converged. The inundation with death of the area closest to the hypocenter, writes the American psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who interviewed survivors at length, was such that if a man survived within 1,000 meters, 0.6 miles, and was out of doors, more than 9/10 of the people around him were fatalities. Only the living, however inundated, can describe the dead. But where death claimed 9 out of 10, or closer to the hypercenter, 10 out of 10, a living voice describing necessarily distorts. Survivors are like us, but the dead are radically changed, without voice or civil rights or recourse. Along with their lives, they have been deprived of participation in the human world. There was a fearful silence, which made one feel that all people and all trees and vegetation were dead, remembers Yoko Ota, a Hiroshima writer who survived. The silence was the only sound the dead could make. In what follows among the living, remember them.
They were nearer the center of the event.
They died because they were members of a different polity, and their killing did not therefore count officially as murder. Their experience most accurately models the worst case of our common future. They numbered in the majority in Hiroshima that day. Still, only light, not yet blast. Hachiya. I asked Dr. Koyama what his findings had been in patients with eye injuries. Those who watched the plane had their eye grounds burned, he replied. The flash of light apparently went through the pupils and left them with a blind area in the central portion of their visual fields. Most of the eye ground burns are third degree, so cure is impossible. And a German Jesuit priest reporting on one of his brothers in Christ. Father Kopp was standing in front of the nunnery, ready to go home. All of a sudden, he became aware of the light, felt that wave of heat, and a large blister formed on his hand. A white burn with the formation of a bleb is a grade 4 burn. Now light and blast together. They seem simultaneously to those close in. A junior college girl. Ah, that instant! I felt as though I had been struck on the back with something like a big hammer and thrown into boiling oil. I seemed to have been blown a good way to the north, and I felt as though the directions were all changed around. The first junior college girl, the one whose teacher called everyone to look up. The vicinity was in pitch darkness. From the depths of the gloom, bright red flames rise crackling and spread moment by moment. The faces of my friends, who just before were working energetically, are now burned and blistered, their clothes torn to rags. To what shall I liken their trembling appearances as they stagger about? Our teacher is holding her students close to her, like a mother hen protecting her chicks. And like baby chicks, paralyzed with terror, the students were thrusting their heads under her arms. The light did not burn those who were protected inside buildings, but the blast found them out. That boy had been in a room at the edge of the river, looking out at the river, when the explosion came. And in that instant, as the house fell apart, he was blown from the end room across the road on the river embankment and landed on the street below it. In that distance, he passed through a couple of windows inside the house, and his body was stuck full of all the glass it could hold. That is why he was completely covered with blood like that. The blast wave, rocketing several hundred yards from the hypocenter at 2 miles per second, and then slowing to the speed of sound, 1,100 feet per second, threw up a vast cloud of smoke and dust. My body seemed all black, a Hiroshima physicist told Lifton. Everything seemed dark, dark all over. Then I thought, the world is ending. Yoko Ota, the writer, felt the same chill. I just could not understand why our surroundings had changed so greatly in one instant. I thought it might have been something which had nothing to do with the war, the collapse of the earth, which it was said would take place at the end of the world. Within the city, notes Hachiya, who was severely injured, the sky looked as though it had been painted with light sumi, that is calligraphy ink, and the people had seen only a sharp, blinding flash of light. While outside the city, the sky was a beautiful, golden yellow, and there had been a deafening roar of sound. Those who experienced the explosion within the city named it Pika, flash, and those who experienced it farther away named it Pikadon, flash boom. The houses fell as if they had been sighed. A fourth grade boy. When I opened my eyes after being blown at least 8 yards, it was dark, as though I had come up against a black painted fence. After that, as if thin paper was being peeled off one piece at a time, it gradually began to grow brighter. The first thing that my eyes lighted upon then was the flat stretch of land with only dust clouds rising from it. Everything had crumbled away in that one moment and changed into streets of rubble, street after street of ruins. Hachiya and his wife ran from their house just before it collapsed, and terror opened out into horror. The shortest path to the street lay through the house next door, so through the house we went, running, stumbling, falling, and then running again until, in headlong flight, we tripped over something and fell sprawling into the street. Getting to my feet, I discovered that I had tripped over a man's head. "Excuse me. Excuse me, please," I cried, hysterically. A grocer escaped into the street. The appearance of people was, well, they all had skin blackened by burns. They had no hair, because their hair was burned, and at a glance you couldn't tell whether you were looking at them from in front or in back. They held their arms in front of them, and their skin, not only on their hands but on their faces and bodies too, hung down. If there had been only one or two such people, perhaps I would not have had such a strong impression, but wherever I walked, I met these people. Many of them died along the road. I can still picture them in my mind, like walking ghosts. They didn't look like people of this world. They had a very special way of walking, very slowly. I myself was one of them. The peeled skin that hung from the faces and bodies of these severely injured survivors was skin that the thermal flash had instantly blistered and the blast wave had torn loose. A young woman. I heard a girl's voice clearly from behind a tree. Help me, please. Her back was completely burned, and the skin peeled off and was hanging down from her hips. The rescue party brought my mother home. Her face was larger than usual, her lips were badly swollen, and her eyes remained closed. The skin of both her hands was hanging loose as if it were rubber gloves. The upper part of her body was badly burned. A junior college girl. On both sides of the road, bedding and pieces of cloth had been carried out, and on these were lying people who had been burned to a reddish-black color, and whose entire bodies were frightfully swollen. Making their way among them are three high school girls who look as though they were from our school. Their faces and everything were completely burned, and they held their arms out in front of their chests like kangaroos, with only their hands pointed downward. From their whole bodies, something like thin paper is dangling. It is their peeled-off skin, which hangs there, and, trailing behind them, the unburned remnants of their puttees. They stagger exactly like sleepwalkers.
A young sociologist. Everything I saw made a deep impression. A park nearby, covered with dead bodies waiting to be cremated. Very badly injured people evacuated in my direction. The most impressive thing I saw was some girls, very young girls, not only with their clothes torn off, but with their skin peeled off as well. My immediate thought was that this was like the hell I had always read about.
A 5-year-old boy. That day after we escaped and came to Hijiyama Bridge, there were lots of naked people who were so badly burned that the skin of their whole body was hanging from them like rags.
A 4th-grade girl.
The people passing along the street are covered with blood and trailing the rags of their torn clothes after them. The skin of their arms is peeled off and dangling from their fingertips, and they go walking silently, hanging their arms before them.
A 5-year-old girl.
People came fleeing from the nearby streets. One after another, they were almost unrecognizable. The skin was burned off some of them and was hanging from their hands and from their chins. Their faces were red and so swollen that you could hardly tell where their eyes and mouths were. From the houses, smoke black enough to scorch the heavens was covering the sky. It was a horrible sight.
A 5th-grade boy compiling a list.
The flames which blaze up here and there from the collapsed houses as though to illuminate the darkness. The child making a suffering, groaning sound, his burned face swollen up balloon-like and jerking as he wanders among the fires. The old man, the skin of his face and body peeling off like a potato skin, mumbling prayers while he flees with faltering steps. Another man pressing with both hands the wound from which blood is steadily dripping, rushing around as though he has gone mad and calling the names of his wife and child. Ah, my hair seems to stand on end just to remember. This is the way war really looks.
But skin peeled by a flash of light and a gust of air was only a novelty among the miseries of that day. Something unusual the survivors could remember to remember. The common lot was random, indiscriminate, and universal violence, inflicting terrible pain. The physics of hydraulics and leverage and heat run riot. A junior college girl.
Screaming children who have lost sight of their mothers. Voices of mothers searching for their little ones. People who can no longer bear the heat, cooling their bodies in cisterns. Everyone among the fleeing people is dyed red with blood.
The thermal flash and the blast started fires, and very quickly the fires became a firestorm, from which those who could ambulate ran away,
and those who sustained fractures or were pinned under houses could not. 2 months later, Liebau's group found the incidence of fractures among Hiroshima survivors to be less than 4.5%. It was not that the injuries were few, the American physicians note. Rather, almost none who had lost the capacity to move escaped the flames. A 5-year-old girl. The whole city was burning. Black smoke was billowing up, and we could hear the sound of big things exploding. Those dreadful streets. The fires were burning. There was a strange smell all over. Blue-green balls of fire were drifting around. I had a terrible, lonely feeling that everybody else in the world was dead and only we were still alive.
Another girl, the same age.
I really have to shudder when I think of that atom bomb which licked away the city of Hiroshima in 1 or 2 minutes on the 6th of August, 1945. We were running for our lives. On the way, we saw a soldier floating in the river with his stomach all swollen. In desperation, he must have jumped into the river to escape from the sea of fire. A little farther on, dead people were lined up in a long row. A little farther on, there was a young woman lying with a big log fallen across her legs so that she couldn't get away. When Father saw that, he shouted, "Please, come and help!" But not a single person came to help. They were all too intent on saving themselves. Finally, Father lost his patience and shouting, "Are you people Japanese or not?" He took a rusty saw and cut off her legs and rescued her. A little farther on, we saw a man who had been burned black as he was walking. A first-grade girl whose mother was pinned under the wreckage of their house. I was determined not to escape without my mother. But the flames were steadily spreading, and my clothes were already on fire, and I couldn't stand it any longer. So, screaming, "Mommy! Mommy!" I ran wildly into the middle of the flames. No matter how far I went, it was a sea of fire all around, and there was no way to escape. So, beside myself, I jumped into our civil defense water tank. The sparks were falling everywhere, so I put a piece of tin over my head to keep out the fire. The water in the tank was hot like a bath. Beside me, there were 4 or 5 other people who were all calling someone's name. While I was in the water tank, everything became like a dream, and sometime or other, I became unconscious. 5 days after that, I learned that Mother had finally died, just as I had left her.
Similarly, a woman who was 13 at the time, who was still haunted by guilt when Lifton interviewed her 2 decades later.
"I left my mother there and went off. I was later told by a neighbor that my mother had been found dead, face down in a water tank, very close to the spot where I left her. If I had been a little older or stronger, I could have rescued her. Even now, I still hear my mother's voice calling me to help her."
Beneath the wreckage of the houses along the way, recounts the Jesuit priest, many have been trapped, and they scream to be rescued from the oncoming flames.
"I was completely amazed," a 3rd-grade boy remembers of the destruction.
"While I had been thinking it was only my house that had fallen down, I found that every house in the neighborhood was either completely or half collapsed. The sky was like twilight. Pieces of paper and cloth were caught on the electric wires. On that street, crowds were fleeing toward the west. Among them were many people whose hair was burned, whose clothes were torn, and who had burns and injuries. Along the way, the road was full to overflowing with victims, some with great wounds, some burned, and some who had lost the strength to move further. While we were going along the embankment, a muddy rain that was dark and chilly began to fall. Around the houses, I noticed automobiles and footballs and all sorts of household stuff that had been tossed out. There was no one who stopped to pick up a thing.
But against the background of horror, the eye of the survivor persisted in isolating the exceptional. A 35-year-old man, A woman with her jaw missing and her tongue hanging out of her mouth was wandering around the area of Shinshomachi in the heavy black rain. She was heading toward the north, crying for help. A 4-year-old boy. There were a lot of people who were burned to death, and among them were some who were burned to a cinder while they were standing up. A 6th grade boy. Nearby, as if he were guarding these people, a policeman was standing, all covered with burns and stark naked, except for some scraps of his trousers. A 17-year-old girl. I walked past Hiroshima Station and saw people with their bowels and brains coming out. I saw an old lady carrying a suckling infant in her arms. I saw many children with dead mothers. I just cannot put into words the horror I felt. At Aoi Bridge, I was walking among dead people. It was like hell. The sight of a living horse burning was very striking. A schoolgirl saw a man without feet walking on his ankles. A woman remembers, a man with his eyes sticking out about 2 inches called me by name and I felt sick. People's bodies were tremendously swollen. You can't imagine how big a human body can swell up. A businessman whose son was killed. In front of the first middle school, there were many young boys the same age as my son. And what moved me most to pity was that there was one dead child lying there, and another who seemed to be crawling over him in order to run away. Both of them burned to blackness. A 30-year-old woman. The corpse lying on its back on the road had been killed immediately. Its hand was lifted to the sky, and the fingers were burning with blue flames. The fingers were shortened to 1/3 and distorted. A dark liquid was running to the ground along the hand. A 3rd grade girl. There was also a person who had a big splinter of wood stuck in his eye. I suppose maybe he couldn't see, and he was running around blindly.
A 19-year-old Ujina girl.
I saw for the first time a pile of burned bodies in a water tank by the entrance to the broadcasting station. Then I was suddenly frightened by a terrible sight on the street 40 to 50 meters from Shukaien Garden. There was a charred body of a woman standing frozen in a running posture, with one leg lifted and her baby tightly clutched in her arms. Who on earth could she be? A 1st grade girl. A streetcar was all burned, and just the skeleton of it was left, and inside it all the passengers were burned to a cinder. When I saw that, I shuddered all over and started to tremble. The more you hear, the sadder the stories get, writes a girl who was 5 years old at Hiroshima. Since just in my family there is so much sadness from it, deduces a boy who was also 5. I wonder how much sadness other people must also be having. Eyes watched as well from the other side. A history professor, Lifton, interviewed. I went to look for my family. Somehow I became a pitiless person, because if I had pity, I would not have been able to walk through the city, to walk over those dead bodies. The most impressive thing was the expression in people's eyes. Bodies badly injured, which had turned black, their eyes looking for someone to come and help them. They looked at me and knew that I was stronger than they. I saw disappointment in their eyes. They looked at me with great expectation, staring right through me. It was very hard to be stared at by those eyes. Massive pain and suffering and horror everywhere the survivors turned was their common lot. A 5th grade boy. I and mother crawled out from under the house. There we found a world such as I had never seen before, a world I'd never even heard of before. I saw human bodies in such a state that you couldn't tell whether they were humans or what.
There is already a pile of bodies in the road, and people are writhing in death agonies.
A junior college girl. At the base of the bridge, inside a big cistern that had been dug out there, was a mother, weeping and holding above her head a naked baby that was burned bright red all over its body. And another mother was crying and sobbing as she gave her burned breast to her baby. In the cistern, the students stood with only their heads above the water and their two hands, which they clasped as they imploringly cried and screamed, calling their parents. But every single person who passed was wounded, all of them, and there was no one to turn to for help.
A 6-year-old boy.
Near the bridge, there were a whole lot of dead people. There were some who were burned black and died, and there were others with huge burns who died with their skins bursting, and some others who died all stuck full of broken glass. There were all kinds. Sometimes there were ones who came to us asking for a drink of water. They were bleeding from their faces and from their mouths, and they had glass sticking in their bodies. And the bridge itself was burning furiously. The details and the scenes were just like hell.
2 first-grade girls.
We came out to the Miyuki Bridge. Both sides of the street were piled with burned and injured people, and when we looked back, it was a sea of bright red flame. The fire was spreading furiously from one place to the next, and the sky was dark with smoke. The emergency aid station was jammed with people who had terrible wounds, some whose whole body was one big burn. The flames were spreading in all directions, and finally the whole city was one sea of fire, and sparks came flying over our heads.
A 5th-grade boy.
I had the feeling that all the human beings on the face of the earth had been killed off, and only the 5 of us, that is his family, were left behind in an uncanny world of the dead. I saw several people plunging their heads into a half-broken water tank and drinking the water. When I was close enough to see inside the tank, I said, "Oh!" out loud, and instinctively drew back. What I had seen in the tank were the faces of monsters reflected from the water, dyed red with blood. They had clung to the side of the tank and plunged their heads in to drink, and there in that position they had died. From their burned and tattered midi blouses, I could tell that they were high school girls. But there was not a hair left on their heads. The broken skin of their burned faces was stained bright red with blood. I could hardly believe that these were human faces.
A physician sharing his horror with Hachiya. Between the heavily damaged Red Cross Hospital and the center of the city, I saw nothing that wasn't burned to a crisp. Streetcars were standing at Kawaacho and Kamiacho, and inside were dozens of bodies blackened beyond recognition. I saw fire reservoirs filled to the brim with dead people who looked as though they had been boiled alive. In one reservoir I saw a man, horribly burned, crouching beside another man who was dead. He was drinking blood-stained water out of the reservoir. In one reservoir there were so many dead people there wasn't enough room for them to fall over. They must have died sitting in the water. A husband helping his wife escape the city. While taking my severely wounded wife out to the riverbank by the side of the hill of Nakahiro Machi, I was horrified, indeed, at the sight of a stark naked